next presenter, I hope you're ready. He's from ACCA. Am I right? Thank you very much. Nicholas van Wyk. And yeah, I think he's head of technical policy, Nicholas. Thank you. You're welcome. You are a familiar face also. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable members, thank you for the opportunity to present the ACCA presentation on the Tax Admin Bill. I'm Nicholas van Wyk, and my co-presenter is Johnny Iliadis, a technical panel member. He specifically at the end will relay three examples to you on how the Tax Admin Bill will affect taxpayers. He's got a practice in servicing small and medium enterprises, and we thought it will be worthwhile for just to share practical experience with you instead of just focusing on the technical. My own presentation will be technical, and then I'm going to hand over to Johnny.
Let me just share with you that you have 20 minutes between the two of you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
It's going to be a long 20 minutes. All right.
All right. I just wanted to make sure that you are aware.
All right. So our presentation has three parts. Part one, we're going to share with you 12 tenets of taxation, which we believe should be used as a guidance in simplification of tax law and a law that's currently before us, the Tax Admin Bill. So it's specifically there, because how else will we evaluate whether the Tax Admin Bill should be accepted or not if it meets certain principles? And that's why we've included the principles for you. In general, what we want you to take home is the concept of balancing the rights and obligations between SARS and the taxpayer. We concur with the previous presenters that there are significant new powers introduced by the Tax Admin Bill, and taxpayers need to be safeguarded. All right, so we support simplification of the tax system as proposed by the TAB. It consolidates the administrative parts of various statutes that the depositors who must take out. However, the risk is the increase in unnecessary compliance costs for taxpayers due to significant new powers allocated to SARS. Our presentation in three parts. We want to make a note of appreciation to SARS. The consultative approach adopted by SARS was wonderful. The ACCA made a number of submissions on the draft TAB over a period of 2 years, and we believe the SARS process should be modeled. We should be a model for all legislative drafting processes. And we don't see that the TAB should be postponed. We believe SARS can implement. All right, the 12 tenants will assist the committee in making a critical assessment of the TAB. And what are these 12 tenants? Avoidance versus evasion. Avoidance, everybody is against it. It's unlawful, it's unacceptable. However, evasion is something different. It's a normal practice. For instance, you claim a tax deduction. So the TAB shouldn't throw both of these out. It should recognize the right of a taxpayer to plan his tax affairs in terms of the tax law. Tax as a percentage of GDP should be stated explicitly. The TAB should not increase the level of taxation by increasing tax compliance costs. That's our biggest fear with the TAB. Tax simplification and stability, it's a priority so that the taxpayer can understand what's required of him and pay his fair share of tax. There's no obligations on taxpayers. They should be aware of these and they should be protected, especially small businesses suffer most if there's increase in tax laws due to anti-avoidance measures. But the small businesses have no time to engage in esoteric tax planning and are simply trying to cope with the volume of laws. So again, it's the 80-20 principle. Most people are compliant with tax. How do we know this? So we each year break all the records in the amount of tax we collect. So we're very successful in the amount of tax we collect. There are the bad apples, but let's then focus on them and not on all taxpayers and overburden all taxpayers. Openness, transparency and accountability is a principle that should be adhered to. It shows that the taxpayer should be informed when SARS has an investigation on him, or whether a third person is requested to provide information on the taxpayers. So all information should be made available, and people should be informed and know what's happening with their affairs. Because these powers of SARS is not only allocated or targeted on the bad apples, it also targets compliant taxpayers. I think, again, that's the biggest point we want to make. I'm a taxpayer, I'm a compliant taxpayer, I have an accountant, a tax practitioner, all my returns are filed, but despite my compliance with the tax law, SARS can on a random basis select me for an investigation for no reason other than that I'm a taxpayer. And that is then a third thing which I must do in addition to my being already compliant, and we don't see the rationale for that. However, if SARS is adamant in that they want to do random investigations, even on compliant taxpayers, then surely if there's no new taxes collected, the taxpayer must be refunded for the cost incurred on this additional investigation. Because in that way we can limit abuse of the taxpayer. All right, certainty is important, tax competitiveness, efficiency, and the sunset clause, which we believe is very important. From time to time, SARS introduces new anti-avoidance legislation for a particular purpose and reason. However, the economy might change, the underlying rationale for the avoidance might have changed. So we need to review them. They should have a sunset clause to be removed if they're no longer necessary. I just want to move on to our part two, specific comments. All right, so this is where it becomes a lot technical. We provided two submissions, a nice table, and this PowerPoint presentation with all the nice colors. I took a lot of effort in preparing this. I hope you enjoy it. All right, so part two, specific comments. A serious tax offense under Section 1. Currently, it introduces either a conviction, an imprisonment for a period exceeding 2 years, but there's no limitation placed on the penalty. So we're just asking in certain minimum fine amount above which an offence will become a serious tax offence. So it's not to make all offences serious tax offences. Chapter 2, Section 32, the administration of the Tax Act has a certain definition. It includes a consideration of future tax periods, but we believe that SARS should not be entitled to call for information prior to the conclusion of a transaction. So it's not when you just consider a few options before you make a conclusion on the option you want to choose. So we ask to remove the term future tax period. Section 16, the mandate of the tax ombud, I suppose it came out in all the previous presentations, it should be increased. So I just want to reiterate it, the mandate of the tax ombud should be increased. We request that, please. The reasons, you can see there in our table, SARS has a lot of new powers, a random investigation of a taxpayer, and I want to highlight that, including the compliant taxpayer. It can order any person to provide material related to the tax affair of another person, and this isn't the employer-employee relationship where the employer would divulge PAYE information to SARS. This is just, I run a business, I have a client, and now I must divulge information on my client to SARS. For no other reason than SARS is requesting this. Order any person to appear before a senior SARS official and share information related to the tax affairs of another person. It relates to my previous example. Perhaps, and we don't necessarily agree with this, SARS should have the power to call any person they like. I perhaps have lunch with my client, and now they call me after lunch and say, what was discussed, what was this transaction all about? But it might not lead to anything. It's a silly example, I agree. So we're not saying that action shouldn't happen. We just say that if it leads to nothing, then surely the taxpayer should be compensated for the time expensed sitting in SARS office. And therefore we ask for certain powers to be increased of the tax ombud. Faulty procedures should be included. It should be included in a review of the faulty procedures, unfair treatment, bias and prejudice action by SARS, misleading or inadequate advice given by the revenue authorities, refusal by authorities to answer reasonable questions, mistakes in handling claims of taxpayers, frivolous investigations conducted randomly by SARS. That's for us the most important one. So that's kind of a check that keeps SARS in conducting their affairs appropriately. And lastly, the tax ombud should also be able to issue penalties against SARS for possible misconduct. If a taxpayer is liable to pay penalties, then surely we should ensure a level playing field and have SARS also subject to certain penalties, and making recommendations for the improvement of the tax system. All right, section 26, relating to third party returns, the commissioner may require a person or employee pay the amount or transact with any other person. So this goes beyond the employee-employee relationship, it includes a business relationship, to submit a return with the required information to SARS. So we're just saying that, and this is one, includes a compliant taxpayer, so we're just asking that the taxpayer has the right to know what information is being shared with SARS about these affairs. A taxpayer's privacy and reputation should be protected. Secrecy should only be allowed in the event that SARS suspects fraud or unlawful conduct. The section allows SARS to gather information from persons other than taxpayer's employer. This will be especially hard-hitting on small business owners in providing this information to SARS. And SARS should be prevented from conducting frivolous inquiries that has not increased the tax base but only increased compliance costs. That, I think, is the key of our submission. So we ask for a certain insert that will prevent SARS from acting in this manner. Section 28, SARS may require a person to submit a certificate, a statement by the other person setting out certain details. So the tax practitioner, accountant, could prepare financial statements on behalf of his client, and SARS then suggests that they should get an additional report on those financial statements. We support this additional support, report that might be issued. There's no issue that, that SARS should require this. However, we ask that it should be linked to the Companies Act requirements, either an accounting officer report, an independent review report, or an audit report, so that there's alignment between the different statutes. And then I move to a bit complex issue, the reportable arrangements. Reportable arrangements in Section 34 has been with us for a number of years, so I'm not trying to ask that it should be removed. It's got good case law underlying reportable arrangements. I was just thinking that there's a new definition included in Section 34, financial reporting standards. And according to the suggestion, it means in the case of companies, financial reporting standards as prescribed by the Companies Act. And in any other case, it currently reads IFRS. So on the screen, you'll see what our suggestion is on the definition of financial reporting standards. And why that is important is that the Companies Act says that only if you're a big, large company do you need to prepare financial statements in terms of IFRS. It seems, and I'm sure it wasn't the intention, that the implication of this new definition is that all companies, even if you're small, sole proprietors, partnerships, will all have to consider and prepare financial statements in terms of IFRS to make this consideration whether a transaction should be reported or not. So we're asking that SARS should perhaps relook the current suggestion so as not to unwittingly require all businesses to prepare financial statements in terms of IFRS, because that would be unnecessary and very costly. It also relates to when a transaction should be a reportable arrangement. Currently, the comparison is between whether something is a deduction in terms of tax law and not disclosed as an expense in terms of IFRS. Many small companies prepare financial statements in terms of a tax basis of accounting. So by necessity, they won't disclose something in their financial statements in terms of IFRS because they're not applying IFRS. So we're just thinking that care should be taken that the right of only the correct things are included in Section 35. So Section 40, it says SARS may elect a person for inspection on the basis of any consideration, including on a random basis. And we have a whole discussion there in that table on why the randomness of the should be removed. So we ask that please remove the word random, include a sentence requiring SARS to have some suspicion about a taxpayer before it conducts an investigation, because 80% of taxpayers are already compliant. Why should they be overburdened? And even if the committee decides that it is still appropriate, but please then ask for some due diligence report or an assessment of return on investment so that SARS can annually report back to you and say, yes, we've inspected so many compliant taxpayers and this is the amount of taxes which we collected. Otherwise, why do the effort? Include a general provision that entitles the taxpayer to compensation in the event that the inspection turns out to be frivolous, which we think will be in most cases. We have an example from a UK experience. It's on page 9 of the table. It says, frivolous random tax inspections will negatively affect small businesses the most. According to the Federation of Small Businesses in the UK, tax inspections last longer in small businesses and produce the least additional tax, often at a significant psychological cost to the business owner and reputational risk. Over the past few years, the taxman has stepped up the pressure on small businesses with a huge increase in investigations, but the crackdown has yielded only a small increase in the amount clawed back by the revenue services. So please be careful. If the UK can make mistakes, and we see on the TV they make a lot of mistakes these days, then surely it can happen with us as well. Section 47, it says a senior SARS official may require a person, whether or not chargeable to tax, to attend for the purpose of being interviewed by SARS. So it's calling a third party and gathering information from him on another person. So we're just saying that the cost of tax investigation and collection should not be transferred from SARS to another person. We're saying that SARS has a mandate, collect the tax, identify the bad apples, remove them, and collect the penalties from them. Don't use other persons for that service. Employ your own employees. Hundreds of thousands of business transactions are entered between contracting parties, and this is an important point. Because if myself and a third party enter into a transaction, before I enter into the transaction with the new proposals, I have to reconsider my actions with this person. The current provision introduces an artificial barrier to freedom of association and trade. The cost of doing business will increase as a transaction will have to provide for the possible risk and cost of being summoned to appear before a SARS official, even though the transaction is perfectly legitimate. My price will increase because I'm going to have a potential cost of appearing before SARS and explaining the transaction. So I have to be recouped by that. And we make a suggestion. Section 241 is a welcome addition. A senior SARS official may lodge a complaint with a controlling body. We've been asking for this for many years. And again, there's already, what we need to do is just align all the professional bodies' code of ethics so that if SARS lays a complaint with a professional body, that non-compliant tax practitioners are treated in the same manner. And then lastly, I'm going to do my part 3, and that is just an asking, this is the third time I'm requesting it from the committee. I started with this, or the ACCA did in our budget assessments last year. We did it this year again, and maybe third time lucky. An Office of Tax Simplification. The UK recently started this as a permanent appointment. It's a committee that reports to that will report to this committee on how the tax laws could be reviewed and simplified. The TAB and SARS and National Treasury should be congratulated on the new approach. It does simplify the tax administration. We just think it should be part of a permanent office that re-looks all of the tax laws and continuously make recommendations. Perhaps an independently appointed committee consisting of business people, members of this committee, and to simplify the tax system, ease administration, and reduce uncertainty for small businesses. Report to this committee, as I said. And that is our presentation. I just want to hand over to Johnny. I've discussed a lot of technical issues, perhaps speaking a bit in the air, so I'm going to make it very practical and ask him to share with you 3 examples that he has with the tax administration and his clients. Johnny.
Good day. Thank you very much.
Just Ben, they are sitting behind you.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you for the, and I really appreciate this. I'm usually the tax practitioner working on the other side. I'm an ACCA member. I sit on the board of the South African ACCA panel, and I sit on the board of ABRA. In my practice, we have specialized in enterprise development. We go after success stories, and 80% of my clients are black clients that have come up and have got tenders and they're trying to make a better future for themselves. The way we do this is actually by dealing with three criteria. We look at coaching, we look at strategy, and we look at financial reporting. The reason why I'm actually telling you this is because this bill, if it's not considered very carefully, I feel you're going to kill the spirit of the taxpayer, okay? Because that will be a lose-lose situation. A lot of times I go and I consult with businesses, and the one thing that gets a business to push through is mindset, okay? And I want to give you these three examples on what taxes can do to a business owner and what can make him give up. So the one is, about 2 weeks ago, I did the tax returns for a pastor. He phones me and he's hysterical. He says, they're after me again. I can't believe this. This is the third time this is happening to me. So I said, what is it? They've just sent me a letter. I think I have to sell everything. They're after me. So I said, just relax. Just bring the letter to the office. This is a normal pastor, gets a salary, and now he thinks he has to sell his house, okay? And we had submitted his documents three times. And the thing is, we had to go to SARS and we billed him for that stuff, okay? So normal tax return, but they wanted information. Then afterwards we found out there was a system error, the capturing and all that, but there was a bill to be paid. And there was a psychological thing also. This guy couldn't sleep at night. He was phoning me every morning. What is Sasha? What is Sasha? Am I in trouble? What's happening? Okay? So there is a psychological thing on the way we approach people. And this is a pastor. He gets audited every single year. Never, ever anything wrong. But it just happens all the time. My second example is a gentleman who started was an engineer, and he got the privilege of being in an incubator scheme, and he opened his own little company. Well, it was little at the beginning, and he knew nothing about books or anything, but his business went very well, so well in 2-3 years that he owed the receiver 1.5 million rand. Okay. He actually took it on himself and he went to the receiver and he said, this is my financial statement, I don't know, this is my situation, please help me. And they just started taking money out of his account. So his people weren't paid. One time they took 200,000 rand out of his account. And he went there and he said, can I give you 50,000 rand a month? Can I give you 100,000 rand a month? This is my situation. I'll give you everything I have, but I have to pay my people. So about 4 weeks ago, he phoned me and says, John, please come and help me, I'm in trouble. And the first thing, I always work on the coaching. I always work on the mindset of the business owner. So the first thing I said to him, why don't we close down? Just close. You can't afford this. And I always want to wait for the response because that's going to determine if we're going to get through this. And he said to me, but Johnny, I've taken 3-4 years of my life to build this thing up. I've got people, I've got black new learnerships that I'm paying. These are people are relying on me. These staff's relying on me. We can't give up on these people. So I said, that's all we need. Let's go and fight this thing and come to an agreement. So we made 100,000 rand a month offer to SARS. They said no, they want 800,000 or nothing. So this is a small business. We're killing the spirit, okay? Yes, he made mistakes, but let's consider everything, okay? We can't be taking money out and the poor employees are not getting paid. And the third one is, and last one quickly, is the SARS owed my one client 600,000 rand, okay? It was a simple transaction, one contract, and they kept the money for, I think it was nearly 7 months. These are small businesses. He did a big transaction. They're owed him this money. He needed that money. But every month, SARS phones me to ask me, well, not every month, but SARS phones me and says, how much is your client going to pay this month that? So I said, why? No, because we need our budget. But you owe him 600,000. Now you want him to pay you. So there's no balance anymore.
I'm sure, Johnny, you'll have more examples.
Yes, that's the last one.
Yeah.
That's all I want to say. Those are my examples, and it's happening every day. Thank you.
Thank you. We are ready to take the next presentation. You don't have to leave, but you can just create space for the presenters. You'll take questions later on. We now have to accept the presentation or take the presentation from Etienne Retief, if he's around. from SAIPA. And then it will be followed immediately by Stephen Butlander from the Victoria Mkenge Group of Advocates. Attorney client privilege. We'll hear from you later on.
Good day. Thank you for the opportunity. I think before we go on, I just want to give you a quick position that we have is that we've dealt with this bill in some sort of nature already for some time, and we want to commend SARS for the amount of work they've put into it. If you look at the size of this bill and you look at the issues that we have, and there might be big issues, but it's limited issues, you have to commend SARS for the amount of good that also can come from that bill. And we don't want to forget about the benefits that can be attained from some of these provisions. We have made formal submission. The presentation is more an extract from those because we don't want to go through it in great detail. The first one that we wanted to address was specifically relating to the tax ombud. And if you look at the specific provisions, and there's two specific ones that I've highlighted there. The first is really what the mandate of the tax ombud is. And we don't disagree with the framework of what the tax ombud has to perform. But if you look at what the purpose of this whole system is meant to be, is an escalation, a mechanism where a person can address issues that they have. At the moment, if you wanted to address this issue, you have got certain remedies within SARS, which in many cases you speak to people, you'll find that they are not successful, they're not getting the result that they want. And there's this attitude of that you on a timeline to submit to SARS, to respond to SARS, but there's nothing forthcoming on the other side. It's whatever timeline we might go with, whatever decision. And if you don't like it, you have got alternatives. You can go to court. We can cross, and I must be honest, most taxpayers don't have the money or the time to go to court to get that kind of relief. So to have a provision, so this is at 20 sub 2, where it says that the ombuds recommendation is not to be binding on the taxpayer or on SARS. What purpose does the ombud then actually have? It has no different than what the SSMO at the moment has within SARS to say, oh, you should be doing this, but you know, what if you don't do it? SARS is not bound by it. So there's no real point if you're not going to give it some teeth. So what we'd like to support is a position where the tax ombud really should have teeth. Now, there's been lots of debate as to the extent that the tax ombud should go in terms of its powers, and we fully support the position that SARS has, that it doesn't get involved in the interpretation of tax law itself. That is the domain of the courts. But when it comes to the administrative and the fair and reasonable treatment of taxpayers, the tax ombud should be a key factor. Not the SSMO and the tax ombud, but at the moment, we can't really replace the SSMO. So we believe that if there is sufficient resources and a proper constituted tax ombud that is created, it in fact can replace the SSMO. It can alleviate the need to go to court and the cost and the time delays that it takes to go to court to get relief. And many of the issues that you've even heard here, such as SARS taking money from a taxpayer's account, at the moment, it happens all the time. But what recourse do you have? How do you address that? How do you stop this? How do you pursue the matter? If you're unhappy with the result that you got, how do you pursue it? Our feeling is that the tax ombud is the place where it should happen. And if you don't give the tax ombud sufficient powers to bind in its position, there's no point. We also want to say that if you want to bind that position, it's a difficult situation because why would SARS accept a position where you bind them where, you know, there might be more complex or other issues relating to it. So for both the taxpayer and for SARS's purposes and to ensure that fair and reasonable administrative justice takes place, we also recommend that it be written into the law that not only that the decisions or recommendations be binding by the ombud, but that those could be challenged if you're dissatisfied with that to a court. So there is still the escalation mechanism available if you're dissatisfied with the decision. We also believe that in order for it to really work properly, there has to be consequences for not fulfilling it. Because what's the point of issuing a ruling and saying you have to comply within 60 days the following, and 60 days come and go and you still haven't complied? What's the remedy to it? So we believe that there should be some form of remedy that is also available at that point. Now, if you look at certain other jurisdictions, they have different ideas to it. A perfect circumstance to this would be if you don't comply, if you don't give the benefit to the party who's essentially now asking for relief from the tax ombud, and you still don't comply with that decision or ruling from the ombud, why should you still have a further burden to have to escalate it or deal with the issue? You should then be given the benefit at that point. So if it is, for instance, for an application or decision and it's being stalled and the ombud decides or issues a ruling to say, Sarge, you have 30 days to finalise this and issue your final decision, and they fail to do it, there should be a consequence so that the taxpayer doesn't have to go back and seek further relief. They should immediately get that application approved on the pure principle that SARS failed to properly address it. Something as simple as that, but as harsh as that, might in fact give it some impetus that this tax ombud could work. We believe that a proper constitution to the tax ombud, as well as the binding powers that it has, will, regardless of who is the parties who serve in there and who pays their salary at the end of the day. We believe that that constitution and its framework that it operates in, if that's sufficient enough, we will get sufficient of a result from it that taxpayers will have faith and buy into the system, that will not be clouted by the ideas of independence or any of those matters. And as I said before, we will support obviously a position that if this ombud can be well enough resourced, well enough constituted to actually give that balance of power that's necessary to escalate a matter and give you this expectation of fair and reasonable tax administration without having to look to the courts for that type of relief, or to close your business as the previous speaker that recommended, that in some cases it does happen, then there's no need for other interventions like the SSMO, which, by the way, there's cost there. There's money involved in it. So those resources can be better spent in the Tax Ombud Office. We are in support of the requirements that SARS has asked for to be able to search without the need of a warrant, because we know the need is there. And as mentioned before, we're not trying to look at the general taxpayer. We're looking at the bad apples. And the problem is, how do you distinguish the bad apples from the good? It's very difficult, especially if you're sitting on SARS' side. But what we are more concerned with is not the powers that SARS need, but the potential for the abuse of those powers. And it's not limited to just SARS doing it or its own staff being unauthorized, but non-SARS people using this. You must realize that the general population is not versed enough in these kind of things to know what their rights are on the positions. We've had even emails going around with the commissioner's picture and his signature and telling you how this tax refund is wrong and using it as a phishing scam. Even there, the banks have it every day happening. What stops a person from abusing this, and how do you know this really is an authorized audit or authorized search that is taking place by SARS? So we have certain recommendations. And our recommendations is that it's fine to say senior SARS official needs to exercise this. But the real power, in other words, the real decision as to whether a search and seizure should take place should in fact lie with the highest power of that administration, being the commissioner. It doesn't take that long to get the commissioner or the commissioner's office to issue a letter opposed to what it takes to get a warrant to do the search. We believe that there needs to be proper documentation. First of all, that the commissioner is the one who's issuing it, so that there is at least some point of authority, and of course that authority comes from the highest power being delegated rather than just any senior SARS official who has that. Second is that there has to be a clear way of identifying who it is who's going to exercise that search and seizure. There has to be a way where I can pick up the phone, for instance, and phone and validate that the person who is here who holds this letter is in fact authorized to come and do this search. Because if I haven't been introduced before through an audit, how do I know this is a legitimate search conducted by SARS? Any person could pose that way. We also believe that the information that you intend or that you perceive that you could find there, the scope of what you're looking for, the reasons for what you're doing the search, the same information that you in fact would need in order to obtain a warrant to do such a search should be disclosed to the taxpayer up front. You should also provide the information as to why it is that you are exercising this provision and not first going to the court to seek that warrant. It's only fair because your rights are being impeded here. And at the end of the day, if you stand here and you get SARS shows up and says, we're wanting to do a search here, we don't have a warrant, how do you know this is legitimate? And that's what we're really asking for, is properly authorized, properly understanding who it is, and then most of all, making sure that it's not some scam or that it's unauthorized audit or search is taking place. And lastly, that we're asking that, like we've seen with many of SARS documentation, when you receive it, that there's a standard process to tell the taxpayer what your rights are. Because remember, if we're dealing with a taxpayer who has not necessarily got the means to seek proper advice at that point, how does he know or she knows what her tax or her rights are in terms of law? And we believe that there should be a standard format in this letter that informs the person of their rights that they have of this process that's just taken place. We don't believe that will impede in SARS's ability to administer and to utilize the section properly, but will give a balance of control and at least a sense of understanding from the taxpayer side that this is not just open for anyone to show up and say, I'm from SARS and I'm here to do a search. You've heard many cases being made regarding legal professional privilege, and we are no different. We believe exactly that. And I'll tell you that I believe that legal professional privilege should be in our law for two main purposes. One, every person should have the right to understand the law, how it applies to them, be able to seek counsel and advice without the fear of self-incrimination while preserving their right to privacy. And if you take away a person's ability to go to someone and say, I want advice on what the law says on the following matter, and they can't seek that, what are you actually saying? He's saying, don't seek advice. Or he's saying, seek advice, but the consequences, well, you always have to bear with it. That doesn't sound like a very democratic and constitutional-based state to have. It doesn't sound like a very fair tax system. At the end of the day, the second and probably most important point is that every time a taxpayer walks into your office to seek advice from you, that is purely advice. And if you deal that advice, and it might lead to things such as an objection or appeal, you must realize that those things will and most likely can end up in at least a tax board or court or some function like that. But because you are not an attorney, you're not allowed to have that privilege that common law affords you. But yet, it should be the nature of the advice that you give, not the person who gives it, that should define whether privilege should be there. And the reality is, and it's been pointed out here today before, such as from PwC and that the reality is in South Africa is that accountants, auditors, tax practitioners, we give advice on a daily basis relating to tax law, the administration and interpretation of that, and it's not the exclusive domain of an attorney. In fact, just because you're an attorney or an auditor or an accountant for that matter doesn't make you qualified. What makes you qualified is because you have the level of knowledge required in order to give advice on tax. And that takes a combination of practical as well as theoretical knowledge. And we would in fact say to you that this privilege is not going to impede on SARS's ability to do their job. Because all the provisions that we have, such as for SARS to ask for documentation, information and things from a taxpayer, or for their ability to conduct an audit or a review, or their ability to appoint another party relating to collection of taxes, jeopardy assessment, all of the things that they've added additional rights into this, all of those things still stand. The tax practitioner still has a reportable obligation that he has to report. He'll still most likely have thicker and phased legislation, not others, to in fact comply with in reporting certain activities. So we're not asking for privilege to hide behind. We're asking for privilege so that a taxpayer has rights in order to seek advice. Now, we have got a suggestion of a framework, which I've highlighted there, and I want to point out two basic points of the framework. I'm not going to go through it in great detail. Two basic points for the framework. One, only a person who is competent in giving the advice and who is a professional with a registered body, which remember in turn SARS has the right to, of course, submit a complaint or a query regarding that this person who's not acting in a professional nature must be able to rely on this in giving such advice. And secondly, and it's the very last point that we made, is that it cannot be used for the purposes of committing, promoting, or assisting in the committing of an illegal or a wrongful act. So we're not asking for you to hide behind it. We're asking for a person merely to get advice without the fear of persecution. When it comes to jeopardy assessments and the personal liability with regards to third parties, you've heard other comments on this as well, and we're not going to bore you with the same detail, although we have similar thoughts in the matter. What we'd like to address is one basic point, is that we've, over the years, taken the shift of taking the burden that SARS used to have and shifted it onto the taxpayer and the practitioner and the auditor to essentially at their cost to do. And if you're in practice, you'd realize it is an enormous burden these days to comply with all the various tax laws, reports, returns, inquiries. You file a VAT return these days, 50% likely that you're just going to get a letter of review immediately. Extra time, extra effort to come into it. Now we go, and we're saying is that we allow you to raise an assessment before a tax year is completed, which we fully agree you should be able to. I mean, it's a fundamental element that SARS needs that power. But why would you want to do that? Why should it be the taxpayer to prove that it shouldn't apply? It should be SARS that says, this is why we need to use this provision or invoke this provision. And likewise with personal liability. It shouldn't be applied purely because it can be applied. It should be applied because it's necessary to apply, which means that SARS already has essentially in hand the information and the position that's necessary in order to apply this properly and be fair to the taxpayer. And most importantly, to be fair, these provisions don't actually express that you have the right to object or appeal to a decision or assessment raised by SARS. And surely that should be a fundamental right that every single taxpayer should have. Any decision or any assessment raised by SARS should be open to objection and appeal processes that you'd normally be entitled to, and not a blanket or a draconian power alone that SARS has. Refunds due to taxpayers, we're not wanting to highlight or to address this issue in great detail because you've heard the issues before. But for us, the biggest issue is that we're quite happy that SARS has recognised that there are cases that you need your refund. So there's provision made in the law to say, or in this bill, to say that if you provide guarantee that's suitable, we'll give you your refund, which by all means I'm very happy with. But the problem is that there's no timeline to that. So now we say, here, go to a small business owner and say to him, here we go, we have your VAT, we want to audit it, but we'll get back to you, and we hold your R500,000 in your VAT due, there's your cash flow down the drain. Now, go to a bank and try and see what security you can get. Go to other parties and see what security you can get, the cost and availability to that person. It's not that easy. More so, you look at even the bigger companies. When you take these securities and you don't have a timeline to the security you're given to provide, and this ends up in your balance sheet that you report to your shareholders, it's not going to be a very pretty situation. So we're proposing that we like the provision, but there should be a timeline, that security should be for a limited period, and after that, and that is in line, by the way, with the OECD recommendation in terms of taxonomy and in terms of best practice, is to say that there has to come a point where your inability to audit it timeously should not be the taxpayer's disadvantage.
2 minutes left, so, and I can do with the number of slides.
If I can have one more minute.
You are over-elaborating on each slide.
Can I have one
more? Yeah.
We're really just asking that there needs to be a time limit, such as perhaps a six-month limit, to say that after the 6 months, if SARS is not able to audit and complete, that they pay out the refund and take the risk on that, because it should be SARS's mandate to audit and deal with it appropriately in a proper time and not necessarily shift that burden and that responsibility onto the taxpayer, which is rather unfair. Because of limitation to time, to make one brief comment on with the controlling bodies, we are not dissatisfied with the idea of reporting unprofessional conduct. In fact, we support it fully and full-heartedly. But the problem is that some parties are not with professional bodies and no action is taken against them. And until we have the regulation that is impending on regulating tax practitioners, it's a rather unfair situation. However, if we did recognize things like professional privilege, two persons with professional bodies with proper code of conduct, we would quite happily support the position of reporting and taking action against members who are acting unprofessionally or illegally, because there is a proper balance that's taken place here. And as a final comment, we believe that everything we look at must look at the morality of taxes. In other words, there must be a balancing act. If a taxpayer doesn't believe in the system to be fair and reasonable and that they have the ability to be heard and get reasonable response from it, why must they want to pay their taxes? So So this balancing act, as much powers as we need to give SARS, give it to them. But there has to be, a, on the other side, a balancing point. Otherwise, it's just not moral anymore for a person to comply. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Etia. We'll take the last presentation by Stephen Bartlander, as indicated earlier on, that is from Victoria Mklange, a group of advocates.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for this opportunity. Mr. Chair, members of this committee, I come here today to convey to you the views that represent the collected views of both myself and Advocate Gilbert Marcus SC, together with whom I have prepared the opinion which is before you. I should say that I am from the Victoria Mklange group of advocates, and proudly so, but of course the group of advocates includes many members of advocates who are not here. So the views I make shouldn't be ascribed to them. They haven't expressed views on it. It's not an organizational view, as you know. Advocates express individual views. So the views I express today on behalf of Advocate Marcus SC and myself, and perhaps just very briefly by way of background, I should explain our involvement. We became involved in this process very early on, when SARS had a draft bill at a very early stage, and there were numerous comments that were made, and we were asked to express our views on the constitutionality of various provisions and on various issues. Ultimately, that led to us concluding that the bill which was to be presented to the State Law Advisor was constitutional in all respects, and we have reiterated that in our view, the bill which is presently before this committee is constitutional in all respects, and the opinion that you have before you says that, but of course, the bill is almost 200 sections. It's not possible to set out all of that in detail, and so SARS suggested that we focus only on a number of discrete issues. I propose in this presentation to work through that opinion very briefly, touching particularly on the issues that have come up for discussion before the committee this morning. So I propose to briefly deal with the test for determining whether something is constitutional, then to deal with the question of warrantless search and seizure, which has occupied the committee for some time this morning, briefly to deal with pain, I'll argue later, and the personal liability of tax.
Sorry, Steve, let me just find out. Yes. You say at the commencement of this process,
yes,
you interacted with National Treasury, or SARS?
With SARS, Mr. Chair.
And they requested you to do some work around it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Will not that amount to almost a response to the presentations on behalf of SARS in terms of your presentation to the committee?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, can I just explain my role? What SARS asked was for an opinion from me and Mr. Marcus on whether the bill was constitutional. But as you will be aware, Mr. Chair, an advocate who is requested to give an opinion is ethically bound to give an honest opinion. So even though SARS might have thought that the bill was constitutional, that didn't determine what we thought. We are ethically bound to give an independent opinion on whether we think the bill is constitutional. And the fact that SARS might not like it and that they are the client is utterly irrelevant. We are ethically bound to say, in our honestly held view, whether we think that the bill is constitutional. And so when we say in this opinion that we think that the bill is constitutional, that is our honestly held view, and we would give the same view whether we were asked for an opinion by SARS or by CIPA or by Price Waterhouse. Our view would not change depending on the client. That is our ethical duty, Mr. Chair. I don't know whether that changes the way you wish to characterize it. I just thought I should record that.
Okay. Now, I thought I wanted to be sure, and then we should put it on record,
yes,
that what you are presenting is your legal opinion in terms of the constitutionality of the law.
Correct.
Thanks.
And it's my legal opinion. It is not that of SARS. If SARS happened to disagree with me, so be it. That is irrelevant for my purposes, at least, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then briefly at the end, I will touch on the question of legal professional privilege, which has been dealt with at length today. Mr. Chair, in dealing with the appropriate method of assessing the Constitution, I want to deal with this very briefly But there are three important principles that we apply in determining whether any piece of legislation, including this one, is consistent with the Constitution. The first is that Section 39(2) of the Constitution requires the courts to interpret the law, including this bill, in a manner which promotes the spirit, purport, and objects of the Bill of Rights. So any question of ambiguity or vagueness or doubt will always be interpreted by the courts in a manner that promotes the constitutionality of the bill and that promotes constitutional values. So the fact that the bill is silent on something doesn't mean that it will be interpreted in a way that damages the Constitution. On the contrary, the courts are required to interpret things in accordance with the Constitution. The second is the point made at page 6 of the opinion, which is that all administrators are required to comply with PUJA, the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, even if the Act doesn't say so. So in essence, this bill, if enacted, will be read together with PUJA when SARS applies it. So what that means, for example, is if SARS has a power to render a decision on whether someone is liable for something, even if this bill doesn't say that that decision must be reasonable, it will have to be reasonable because PUJA will require it to be reasonable. So all of the safeguards that Parliament put in place in PUJA apply equally to SARS when it is engaging in administrative action. And so you can read this bill together with PUJA to understand what safeguards there are for the public. The third point, Mr. Chair, and it goes to points that have been raised, is that it is impossible to legislate against abuse. All powers, Mr. Chair, the Constitutional Court has told us, are capable of being abused. But the point is that if they are abused, it is then for the courts to set them aside. And the courts act as the bulwark, the defence against abuse. So what the Constitutional Court said in the Van Rooyen case, which we've quoted, is that any power vested in a functionary by the law or by the Constitution is capable of being abused. But that possibility has no bearing on the constitutionality of the law concerned. The exercise of the power is subject to constitutional control, and should the power be abused, the remedy lies there. I think that's an important point to bear in mind. One has to legislate for good faith attempts by officials, and that is an important point. Can I then move, Mr. Chair, to deal with the first substantive issue which I think I should deal with, and that appears at page 9 of the opinion, and that is the question of warrantless search and seizure, about which you've heard much, Mr. Chair. Can I start by saying that having heard the presentations today, no one is suggesting that warrantless search and seizure should not be allowed at all. It now seems that all of the presenters concur that warrantless search and seizure is necessary and is constitutionally justified in principle. The only question is the manner in which it is legislated consistent with the Constitution? Are there sufficient safeguards to comply with the Constitution? And in that regard, Mr. Chair, the first point is that this bill does not provide a general right for SARS to engage in warrantless searches. On the contrary, in the vast majority of cases, this bill requires there to be a warrant. It is only where, according to the clause, a senior SARS official is satisfied on reasonable grounds that three requirements are met that a warrantless search and seizure can occur. All three requirements, Mr. Chair, must be satisfied. First, there may be an imminent removal or destruction of relevant material likely to be found on the premises. Second, that if SARS had applied for a search warrant would have been issued. And third, that the delay in obtaining a warrant would defeat the object of the search and seizure. So what you are dealing with in this bill is that all three requirements must be satisfied before a warrantless search and seizure can occur. Even then, Mr. Chair, even if all three requirements are satisfied, you still cannot make use of this provision to search someone's home unless the home is being used for a trade. So it's made explicit in the bill that the warrantless search and seizure here will not be able to be used in respect of someone's home. Now, Mr. Chair, that's all very relevant because warrantless search and seizure is not something unprecedented in our law. By our count, there are at least, I think we got to 17 statutes, 17 acts of this Parliament which allow for warrantless search and seizure. And this Act, far from being more invasive of rights than those ones, is actually more protective of people's rights. Can I explain the point this way? If you look at the Criminal Procedure Act, it allows the police to do warrantless searches and seizures. But it doesn't have any requirement which is the same as the first requirement in this bill. It doesn't require that there may be imminent removal and destruction of relevant material likely to be found on the premises. It only has the other two requirements. So this act is more protective of privacy than the Criminal Procedure Act. And secondly, the Criminal Procedure Act doesn't have a home exception. So in the Criminal Procedure Act, you can use that power to search someone's home without a warrant. In this act, that can't happen. So far from this being some sort of unprecedented act, which is much more invasive of privacy than every other act, it's actually less invasive. There are additional checks and balances that have been built in. The next point that I would emphasize is that the Constitutional Court has expressly recognized that warrantless search and seizure is constitutionally permissible, provided that there are checks and balances put in place, which I've discussed. But the final point that I would say, Mr. Chair, is that one needs to understand what the purpose of this provision is. And the example's been given, but can I just reiterate it? Suppose that SARS goes for a routine inspection of some documents at some place of business. And in the process of inspecting those documents, they discover that someone in the back room is burning other documents or shredding other documents. There is no time, Mr. Chair, then to go to the High Court for a warrant, nor, with great respect to the presenter who has just spoken, is there time to get the commissioner personally on the phone or to get him to complete the list of questions which was suggested in the previous presentation. The whole point of this is that this is for exceptional circumstances where speed is required. And that is why the Constitution recognizes that on these kinds of occasions, you can engage in a warrantless search and seizure. So it's not for me to tell this committee what is desirable from a question of policy. That, with great respect, is the committee's point of view. But from a question of the Constitution, I can tell you that there is, in my view and in the views of Advocate Marcus, nothing in this clause which is inconsistent with the constitutional right to privacy. And therefore, we were of the view that this clause would pass constitutional scrutiny, particularly given that at least 20 other OECD countries, as we make the point, also have warrantless search and seizure. Can I move on then from warrantless search and seizure to deal briefly with the pay now, argue later point? This is the point, Mr. Chair, I'm now at page 15 of the opinion. This is the point that where SARS issues an assessment and you are engaged in objecting and appealing, that amount of the assessment is still payable pending your objection and appeal. And there's a suggestion by the Law Society Chair that that is unconstitutional, and so Advocate Marcus and I applied ourselves to whether the clause, which is 164, was unconstitutional on that basis. I can deal with this very briefly, Chair. There are really two responses. The first is that the Constitutional Court has exhaustively considered whether pay now, argue later in a tax context is unconstitutional. They did so in the Metcash case. That case was only about pay now, argue later, and the question of whether it's constitutional. And the Constitutional Court unanimously concluded that it was consistent with the Constitution to have pay now, argue later in the context of a tax act. So the Constitutional Court has already pronounced on this issue, and it's only if you can show that this clause is so much worse than the clause at issue there that it would render it unconstitutional. In our respectful submission, when the clause is read as a whole, compared to the statute at issue in Metcash, it's plain that this clause is constitutional. The second, Mr. Chair, is that this is not a new provision. Section 88 of the existing Income Tax Act is in substance identical to this clause. The existing Income Tax Act, Section 88, as enacted by this Parliament, says that pending an objection and an appeal, tax remains payable unless SARS suspends that obligation. So this clause, although it gives a bit more detail and a bit more guidance, is in substance identical to Section 88 of the Income Tax Act. So this Parliament is not being asked to enact something new or revolutionary. In fact, it's being asked to reenact something which has already been enacted under the old Act. I don't propose to deal with this in more detail then, Chair, unless there are questions which will be raised later. We've dealt in detail with all of the guarantees for people affected, repayment of interest, all sorts of things. We've set them out in the opinion. Chair, the next issue is dealt with at page 19, which is the question of clauses 180 to 184 of the bill, the personal liability of third parties. Chair, no one before this committee, as I can see, has expressly raised concerns about this. I just want to make one brief comment. The only question from a constitutional point of view is, are the people who are going to be held liable for the taxes sufficiently closely connected to the tax liability to allow that to happen? And in our view, having considered the clauses, they are. And, for example, a person whose negligence and fraud results in failure to pay a tax debt, where that person was running the tax affairs, in our respectful view, is sufficiently closely connected to the tax debt to be held personally liable. But I don't want to go into detail about it. The committee has the submission, and as I say, no one has raised it this morning in detail or in the written submission. That then leaves only one substantive issue, Mr. Chair, and it's not addressed in this opinion, but it's the question of legal professional privilege, which has been debated before the committee this morning. The suggestion has been made that it's important that legal professional privilege be extended to people other than lawyers. In other words, that it be extended to tax advisors as well, or accountants. Mr. Chair, it's not for me to say to the committee as a matter of policy whether that is a good idea or a bad idea. That is one issue, and that is not my area of expertise or my mandate. What I am asked, though, is it unconstitutional for the bill only to confer this protection on lawyers and not on accountants or tax advisors? And on that point, Mr. Chair, I have an absolutely definitive answer. It is perfectly constitutional for the bill only to confer that protection on lawyers rather than accountants. Indeed, Mr. Chair, that is what the entire area of our law currently does and has done for many hundreds of years. The point was made that legal professional privilege has been in place for, I think, 300 years. I think that was the figure quoted. We accept that, Mr. Chair, but it's never been conferred on accountants or tax advisors in this country. This committee may want to think about doing so subject to the competing arguments, but it is not required by the Constitution to do so. And there's a reason for that, Mr. Chair, because the right to a fair criminal trial is an essential part of the Constitution, and that's where legal professional privilege comes in. But I am unaware of any country anywhere in the world which has held that it is a requirement of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights for legal professional privilege to extend to accountants as well. I'm unaware of that, and certainly none has been pointed out to me. So it's a question of policy, it's not a question of a constitutional requirement, Mr. Chair. The final point to wrap up then, Mr. Chair, is that there has been a suggestion, particularly in the Law Society's written submission, that some of the powers conferred on SARS by the bill are absolute, unfettered, draconic. With great respect, Mr. Marcus and I simply disagree with that characterization. The notion of unfettered and absolute powers is a contradiction in terms, because all powers, this committee's, SARS's powers, the President's powers, are all subject to control in terms of the Constitution and controlled by the courts. So we simply don't agree with that point. And indeed, far from removing the judiciary, this bill entrenches the role of the judiciary, because whenever it gives far-reaching powers, it allows the judiciary to act as a check on whether to grant warrants, except for the exceptional cases of warrantless search and seizures, on whether to grant an inquiry, and it confers on the taxpayer the right to challenge any decision in the courts. So in the case of warrantless search and seizure, the suggestion is made, well, what happens if someone is wrongly searched? That person, Mr. Chair, would always have a right to review that decision in the courts. And finally, is that the powers conferred on this bill are in no way unprecedented. Similar powers are conferred on various bodies by multiple pieces of legislation in this country and on revenue authorities in other countries. And can I say, Mr. Chair, you've heard a great deal about the public process that SARS followed, and there's been a criticism from certain of the presenters that some of their concerns weren't responded to. And of course, SARS clearly disagrees with some of those concerns. But I can tell you from my point of view and that of Advocate Marcus, whenever we raised a constitutional concern, and we did, informally, in discussions, in all sorts of forums, whenever we had a constitutional concern with the bill, SARS was at pains to remedy it, and that included the constitutional concerns that had been raised by some of the presenters today. So, whatever else has not been taken into account, which is not my mandate, it's absolutely clear that SARS has taken its constitutional concerns responsibly. They have sought to render this bill constitutional, and in our respectful submission, we're of the view that they have succeeded. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I think we have all the three presentations. Now this is the opportunity for honourable members to interact with the three submissions. You would be aware that most of the issues that you have raised, because of speaking about one set of legislation here, would have probably been dealt with in the previous presentations. But nonetheless, we have raised new issues that I think honourable members would want to interact with. Honourable Korenhof.
I just want to ask Advocate Butlinda, you say quite correctly it's a policy decision by broadening the principle of privilege, but I would like to have your opinion on that. Is it a good or a bad thing we're doing?
Any other question? Madame?
The clarity from the advocate, because he keep on he quoted section 61 clause 3 having defined a SARS official as a senior official, whereas that's not true in the bill. If you look at the bill right through, it talks just about the official, even with the session CESAR, which now is only on section 6. So if where is that coming from? Thank you.
Honourable Mteto.
To Johnny, I was interested in listening to those stories. What are you charging your client as well?
Okay. Yeah, let's start with the advocate because I think I've got more questions. But one of the, I think it's a principal question that because you see, in the way or in the normal course of the committee doing its work, at the end of these public hearings, National Treasury is always afforded the opportunity to come and respond to us or to come and give a report or a response to the issue that have been raised. Now that you have come to make a presentation on the legality of the bill or the amendment as proposed, I guess the same has been given to SARS. That's my assumption, because you did not just undertake this particular assignment. You were requested. And probably it was not just done pro amico. Now, this is a sponsored view. So how independent is this? I'm not questioning the integrity of your legal practice, but what we have received today is what the various organizations and individuals would have actually interacted with this law and the content of the law or the amendment bill or tax administration bill to give us their views. And I did not hear anybody saying anything borders on the illegality or the unconstitutionality of the law in all the presentation that we have received. Now, from where I'm sitting, I thought if you were requested by SARS to do this work, it was for SARS to advise them. And it would have been far much better for SARS through National Treasury, when the committee interact with them, to make their own assessment and views if the committee was going to raise those issues. I just wanted probably to get your comment on that. But before, to all other presenters, one of the things that I did not hear, of course, I think it is informed by the fact that the institutions or the institution that we're actually dealing with, which administers the laws of revenue or taxation matters in this country, is regarded as a very powerful institution. It does so within a legislative framework. The assumption is that taxpayers are almost at the disadvantage at all times because they are dealing with a very huge body. And there is a subtle attempt to say you need to balance, checks and balances of this institution, and the office of the ombuds is an option. I don't hear anybody saying, how do we also strike a balance in order to protect the interests of the ordinary citizens of this country in terms of making sure that everybody pays tax and the rights of SARS at the same time. What are the possibilities, in other words, of the office of the ombuds being abused and to frustrate the efforts of the tax administrators to achieve the goals that would have set for ourselves as a country. So I thought we should also just look into that. I think Johnny's examples are very relevant because where we are, we have said 2011 is the year of job creation. Of course, within the confines of what is happening globally, but the impact of the economic recession to small and medium enterprises in particular, because that's the area of job creation, where real jobs are created, in fact, in most instances. And how do you protect a situation where third parties are not inconvenienced? I think that's the point that you raised earlier on. As you freeze the assets of this particular small company, what is the impact of those who are supposed to get their wages at the end of the week or end of the month, 3 days before? And I think National Treasury should have taken note of that point. And probably as we move on, they'll be able to respond to some of those issues. The rest probably I'll comment after you have commented yourself. I'm not putting you on the spot, Bartlander, but I thought for me it's more of a principled matter that the committee should actually be at ease, you know, how we deal with this submission moving forward. Because it might have even prompted the need for others to respond to some of the issues, but they are not going to have that opportunity because they've already done their presentations and so on and so forth. It does help to complement what they've done for the committee. Over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, could I begin with your question, because it is, I think, an important one to deal with up front. Mr. Chair, I obviously can't speak about why I'm presenting here as opposed to presenting as part of a National Treasury engagement, but can I say two things? The first is it's absolutely true that it is SARS who requested me to do this, and it is SARS who is paying me, Mr. Chair. But as I've already said, and you've accepted it, and I'm grateful for that, Mr. Chair, my views are my views whether SARS likes them or not. And I have frequently given opinions to government departments, private clients, and other people who paid me and told them that I disagreed with them, and they've had to live with my advice or find someone else. Who didn't have the same view. So the question of it being a sponsored view, I think, is your concern, as I really understand it, Mr. Chair, is why are these constitutional concerns being raised now in light of your perception that there are no constitutional concerns being raised by others? But with great respect, Mr. Chair, I think that's a slight misconception. If you read the submissions made by the Law Society, which were made to this committee for purposes of this hearing, but they didn't request an oral hearing. They expressly took the point that these clauses were unconstitutional. They expressly said it was not consistent with the Constitution to have clauses which gave SARS the express powers that they have. And so I think it's in that context that SARS felt it was appropriate to put before you the views of Advocate Marcus and myself. Similarly, even this morning, the views put forward by the presenters this morning, some of them said, warrantless search and seizures, this doesn't take account of the requirements of the Constitution. That is a polite and respectful way of saying these clauses are unconstitutional. So I think, Mr. Chair, the reason that if there are no constitutional concerns by anyone, then what I've had to say is irrelevant and I've wasted your time and I hope you will ignore it and forgive me. But I think that the reason that it was raised is because there was a perception by some people that there may be constitutional problems by the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then just to deal with the two specific points that were raised with me. The first is the question of privilege. To the Honourable Member, what I'm going to give you is a personal view. My personal view is that one should only consider extending a privilege with extraordinary caution for the following reason. The protection that is given to legal professional privilege in our law is as high as any other principle in our law imaginable. In other words, it is a cast iron principle. It's not something where you can say, if we had that evidence, we'd be able to convict a murderer, and therefore it's reasonable and justifiable to prevent them to breach legal professional privilege. It is a strict and firm rule, which is extraordinarily cumbersome in some ways on the criminal justice process, and for good reason, let me say. But to now go and extend that to another area with people who are not subject to the same rules as lawyers. Accountants, as you heard from the presenter, some of them are subject to professional rules, and but not all those professional rules have the operation of by law. So my personal view, which is what you've asked for, is that this committee should be very slow to consider extending it beyond lawyers. It is an extraordinary principle, and to start extending it to other areas could have very damaging effects, in my view, for the justice system and the revenue system. And then finally, on the point raised by the Honourable Member, I do apologise, I obviously wasn't clear, I'm sorry to the Honourable Member. I was trying to explain who had the authority to authorise the warrantless search and seizure. If you look at Clause 63.1, it says a senior SARS official, if you look at 63.1, may without warrant exercise the powers referred to in 61.3. So, in other words, even if there are other SARS officials on the ground doing the search, it has to be authorised by a senior SARS official who is satisfied on reasonable grounds that those three requirements are met. The authorisation has to come from the senior SARS official as per Clause 63.1. That's the reference I was making. I wasn't saying that all the people doing the searching would be senior SARS officials, but the person giving the authority has to be a senior SARS official in terms of Clause 63.1. I hope that's answered your question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's your turn.
Thank you. I'd like to just say there's two comments. We don't address the issue of constitutionality with regards to privilege purely because we don't say that there's any problem with the extent of the privilege at the moment. We're saying is that if you want a fair and reasonable system where, and all due respect, comparing it with other than tax law would not be appropriate. We need to look at it purely in the confines of tax law. And in my own personal experience, I have met many people, auditors, professional accountants, that are far better versed at giving tax legal advice than an attorney would. But an attorney has this automatic, let's call it benefit, of a marketing tool that's available to say, why should you use me? That doesn't necessarily just give a fair and proper representation to the taxpayer. We're looking at, you asked the question of, what do we do to, on the other side, look at the balance, why SARS should be able to collect better. A lot of these powers help SARS to collect. But as a general, and it's been mentioned before as well here, is that you can't actually legislate against abuse or force people to pay tax purely because legislation. The end of the day is there are two basic factors that define whether people will pay tax. One, what are their taxes being spent on, and that is not our place to have that discussion. And two, is the fairness and the representation of the tax system itself. Those two are the fundamental points of tax morality. If either of those are not proper, you are going to battle collecting your taxes. And I want to take this opportunity to say SARS has done an extraordinary job in collecting taxes. They are world class in terms of the way in which you submit, the speed at which they assess, the ability to collect those taxes. But that speed, that ability, that wonderful power that they've got there, if the general person in the street who's the taxpayer does not have faith in that system, that when I don't agree with the power being exercised by SARS or the action being taken, that I don't have this balance, such as an ombud or so, that I can pursue or escalate the matter, you are asking that the tax morality be dropped dramatically. And that's what we're saying, is that people should get proper representation from a person competent and qualified to give tax advice and legal advice on tax law, not necessarily just the domain of it. And we appreciate that it's a very delicate thing to ask to extend that privilege, and there is potential for abuse. But if you look at the framework that we suggested, we are suggesting that only people who are, one, competent to do so, that is with a professional body and properly qualified so, and that has a proper code of conduct and mechanism where you can address these issues properally, should in fact be extended this privilege. So we are asking for that to in fact be limited. Thank you.
Yeah, before I hand over to Johnny on the fee question, I would also just support the previous submission that was made. Legal professional privilege can be extended as long as it's managed appropriately. That doesn't mean it shouldn't be extended. So I disagree with the advocate. There's no reason to not extend it, get relevant policies and procedures in place, and then it can be extended. Most advice is given by a host of tax practitioners, not only advocates, and to enhance tax compliance, expand the definition. It's actually a very simple conclusion that can be reached. Chair, on your question, yes, everybody should pay their fair share of tax. It's a political decision, I suppose, what is a fair share of tax. In principle, what I would like to comment is that if a person sees value, so in other words, he pays for something, because that's what tax is, he's paying for a service, but he's paying for a promise of a service. In business, I first deliver the service and then get the money, and there's my risk as a business person. It's a huge risk. And if I don't perform the service, I get wiped out and the competitor takes over. In taxes, I suppose it works the other way around. You first pay the money, and then hopefully you get the service. And I see there might be the issue. The collection of taxes is efficient. We see it in the record number of tax collection we make each year. But perhaps it's when the money is transferred to other departments in service delivery that there might be an issue. So what I'm saying is better service delivery, better taxes. The principle is everybody should ensure their fair share of tax. But tax has also a compliance cost, which in some degree could be argued. And if you want to, as an additional tax, and if you want to be fictitious, nationalisation is in the air, so perhaps tax practitioners should be nationalised. It will maybe address Johnny's question. I'm saying it tongue-in-cheek, committee, please don't take me on as a policy matter. I just want to quote one of the 12 tenets of tax system we've highlighted in our submission, and I just want to quote from this. ICCA does not seek to enter the political debate on the appropriate level of tax and public spending, but substantial tax increases represent a significant burden on business and individuals and should be subject to an impact assessment designed to challenge the need for new regulations and to establish an accurate and updated estimate of costs. Once new measures are put in place, there should be a means of measuring and evaluating their impact in terms of a proclaimed public. So what we're saying is impact assessment. when it comes to compliance measures, the TAP, as well as the new taxes. Is there such a thing? Why isn't it there? There should be a constant review of the tax system to see, but is this the best way of doing things? And hence, our third request to the committee, please consider the Office of a Tax Simplification. It might address these issues. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks for your tongue-in-cheek and admitting that in upfront. I think we've come to the end of today's deliberations. For those of you who will be around Cape Town tomorrow, you are welcome. We are proceeding with the presentation from other organizations and individuals. Mr. Nicholas Van Wyk, my understanding is that you don't pay tax based on future earnings. What you get taxed on is what you've already earned, either in business or in salary. So there's no promise of anything. You get taxed on what you've already earned. And the system would have proven that through the environment that has been created, your business has been very, very, very profitable. That's why then your taxes will be coming in. I thought I should just make that comment. Thank you very much, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen. You are invited again tomorrow to come and listen to other presentations. It has been very, very helpful on our part, honorable members. We have come to the conclusions of today's deliberations. Until tomorrow, thank you very much.